This is CliffCentral.com.
May his soul rest in paradise, man. Marvin Gaye coming through on that one. Got to give it up. I can imagine there's a couple of people who were like, wait, isn't that Robin Thicke's song? No, it's not, in actuality. It was done by Marvin Gaye back in the 70s, man. There's something about 70s music that is just mind-blowing. I mean, these guys, the amount of time and effort and what they put into the music. The soul is not something that can be replicated. It can't be manufactured. It has to be something that comes from your heart. And that's the easiest way to describe people like Marvin Gaye. Welcome to it. It is 20-something. My name is Jack, just another cool kid. Unfortunately, today I'm hanging out by myself. My co-hosts have ditched me. They've decided that, you know, schlepping it all the way to Joburg is just not worth their time. But it's cool. We'll hang out together. If you want to be a part of the conversation, you can send us your tweets at Jack_5'4" or at CliffCentral.com. And I think you'll want to do that primarily because of the person that joins me today. I really don't know how to describe you, but I'll start off by saying, we used to sit in our geography class. Yeah, this is how far back we go. We used to sit in our geography class and listen to jazz music while Miss Stevens would, you know, stand in front of the class and teach. And we thought it was a good idea to listen to jazz. I remember you would hand me one earphone because we sat up against the wall. And he'd hand me one earphone. I'd put the one earphone on my ear. He'd put the other one in there. And you wouldn't notice. I mean, we used to go to that classroom specifically to listen to jazz. I don't remember how much geography was learned, but a lot of great jazz music was played. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm joined by Mr. Jed Aylmer. How are you, my brother?
I'm well, thanks, and you, man?
Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
So let's unpack something really quickly. We both went to King Edward the VII School, and I personally, as we were talking outside, I didn't really enjoy most of it, you know. But I mean, people like yourself made it worth it in a sense, you know what I mean? Once you stepped out of King Edward the VII School in 2007, where did you go? What did you decide? What was on your mind?
I suppose I was lost, to be really honest.
Yeah.
I'm rolling up my sleeves because, you know, we're going to get into the
new. Yeah, we're good. Yes, yes.
You know, like, you step out of that place, which I think grounds you. You know, there's something about that school which, you know, both you and I share, that we had something to go on.
Yeah.
What we had to go on, we didn't even know.
Yeah,
for
sure.
I think that's what happened. And I think I walked out of there and I said, you know, I've started along this art scene.
Mm.
Let's kind of carry on with that.
Yeah.
So I landed up in Wits and studying fine art and studying TV, and I thought I was going to be a rock star behind a canvas.
You know, yeah,
that was,
yeah.
That was where I was destined to be at the time. Mm. How things changed.
Yeah. A lot has changed. A lot has changed.
Yeah.
Let's get into what you do specifically. Like industrial design. For some of us that aren't too clued up on what that is, what is that?
So, industrial design is one of those really hard things to actually stomach, and it's really quite a hard thing to also understand what exactly it is, because it is so much.
Yeah. So I'm not that stupid, okay?
I tell you, like, what happened. So I landed up in fine art, I landed up in TV, and I was doing this, and that was familiar to me. It was something that was kind of easy for me to grasp.
Yeah.
You know, you see TV, you see a painting, you know what you're doing.
Yeah, for sure.
And then I didn't quite see that. I didn't quite enjoy that. So I landed up applying to architecture. Well, you know, my parents are graphic designers. I've always had an interest in buildings. You know, that's kind of where I'm going to be.
Yeah.
And then I pitched up to the open day and they said industrial design. I thought, well, somebody once spoke to me about this, but again, no clue what's going on. So industrial design is kind of a field which overarchs everything about product usage.
Yeah.
So we do anything from a cell phone to a hospital bed to a cool spoon to a car to items that go into space. anything that really a person interacts with as a user.
Yeah.
So user experience, something that you need to design either a physical, emotional, psychological experience towards.
For sure.
And that's really what I think interests me, because I had no idea what I was doing in it. It was a challenge of, well, I've never done it before, so let's do it. So that's what I do. And I then started my own thing, but, you know, I landed up doing all kinds of things in between. You know, you'd even do shop fitting, which, you know, is interesting, but it's at the same time it can be soul-destroying. But there's an amazing sense of accomplishment when you get it all done.
Yeah, for sure. Look, for as long as I've known you, you've been a creative person. So I can imagine how industrial design must have, you know, caught your eye. Yeah. It's one of those things. In fact, the person that mentioned industrial design was Miss Tabor in grade 8.
Wow, yeah, she did.
Yes.
That's right.
In grade 8. Now that it clicks. She was telling us about, what was that guy's name? I can't put my finger on it, but she used one specific example. I think the guy, either went to King Edward the VII or...
Yeah, Brian Steinhoble.
There you go. Mm-hmm. There you go. Yes, he used him as an example. Now it makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's actually how I remembered it, you know, because I walked past the main studio of industrial design and I thought, you know, that Brian Steinhoble, he was at my art exhibition. He said, you know, you should really try this industrial design thing, you know, but all in hindsight, you forget it and you move on.
Yeah.
And that's when it clicked back. Yeah, you're right.
Hey? Right. I've actually got a good memory. Look at that.
I forgot that.
So now, look, here you are. You then decide, you know, industrial design is it. Mm-hmm. And you get your qualification. What did you do with it? Because, you know, I've found that a lot of people go to school, or they find a passion, go to school, study for it, and then straight after that, they've got no place else to go. Like, they ultimately become stuck with this degree that gathers dust at home. So, once you got your degree, what was next?
You know, having a degree with dust on it is something that you don't want, but I think it's actually 90% of the people do have a degree with dust on it.
For sure.
But a bumpier is a bumpier, and you got to have it, you know. I got to the end of my course, and I think, you know, you have an expectation when you walk in the front door what you're going to land up doing.
Yeah.
So everybody who goes into college or school or whatever kind of qualification you're doing, even if it's actually like artisanal training, you've got a very strict idea about what you're going to start off doing.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to be a rock star in that, or you're just going to kind of carry on in that. Like, there's no change in that plan. So when I arrived, I thought I was going to be this kind of superhero industrial designer who is doing really funky cool products that were going to change people's lives in the kitchen.
You know,
like, I was going to come up with a spoon that nobody had ever seen before, and that thing was going to, you know, I was going to be among that group of people that change interiors,
the world,
you know, in that way. And that was the only way that I could change the world. It was the only way that I thought that would change the world.
Yeah.
Because you have no perspective, you know, you have no kind of reference.
For sure.
So I got to the end, and they pushed me for a particular project at the end of my BTEC year. And they said to me, you've got to come up with your own idea. And I thought, well, now's the time that I'm going to do that spoon, you know?
Yeah.
And I landed up following the Nelson Mandela Children's Hospital on an architecture blog.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, you know, maybe that there's something that I can do for this. You know, that maybe that there's something inspiring about that. I always liked medical, but had no idea how to get into it. You know, I wasn't a doctor, and I was never going to pretend to be one either. And I landed up going to one of the local hospitals for kids and having a look around and realizing that there's more of a need for stuff that changes people's lives for the better in another way.
Yeah.
And that was when I looked at that cot and I thought, well, you know, here we go. This has got to change.
You had, as Oprah would say, you had your aha moment.
Yeah. I found the thing under my chair, you know, my what do they call it? The prize. You got one and you go away.
Everybody's got one. Yeah. Oh, man. Because, you know, a lot of us don't pick up on certain things. We don't necessarily look for inspiration all in the same places. I can only imagine you walking through that hospital and seeing what you saw, what would have happened in your mind. It's one of those inexplicable moments where things just come together all of a sudden in your mind. But having to put the action behind that inspiration is often the difference between the people that become something and the people that ultimately sit at home with those ideas. How did it start? What was the first step once you realized that you could actually manufacture maybe you didn't realize that you can manufacture this thing, but what made you want to change the way that cot looked?
I tell you, the moment that you see one of those things and you see a child actually in it, it's quite a profound moment, and I think that was where I felt that I figured out what my training was for. And not in a kind of a save the world sense. It was more in a save one at a time sense. That horrible saying, you know, save many, or, you know, sacrifice one for many, or many, many for one. You know?
Yeah.
And I think that you kind of go into your studies with a sacrifice many for one, and you realize it's the other way around. Well, in my case, I did. I think the moment that I saw that cotton, I saw the kid in, and I saw that it looked like a cage.
Yeah.
I think that was the moment. So, you know, I took that idea and developed up then the new cot. So I did this pediatric hospital cot for kids, you know, aged between 6 months and 5 years. That was different. That was fundamentally from the ground up different.
Yeah.
And it took you a while to get it, but I think there was a moment where I saw that cot and I saw that steel cage and I saw the way that it operated and I saw what the nurses did, and they were, don't get me wrong, they were very innovative in what they were doing, but I thought, like, how unnecessary was that?
Yeah.
Why don't we have a proper product that does the right thing?
Yeah.
And that's where then the idea sort of formed. But, like, how do I was going to get it into manufacture was not even the first thought.
Yeah.
I wasn't even there.
You just knew a change needed to be made.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there was a project deadline.
Yeah.
You know, that drives a lot. You know?
Yeah.
So that was the sort of 6 months of college when I sat down and came up with a small idea.
Mm.
And it was really to get the box ticked and get the degree.
Yeah.
But there was something cool about it that I never forgot, you know, and even though I started working after I got out of college, you know, outside of the cot, it always remained in the back of my head. And I thought, yeah, I always got to show somebody. I got to do something with this thing.
Yeah.
So obviously that journey then happened in a big way.
That's really cool, man. Because when I actually think about it, like, I don't think that type of equipment has been changed in the longest time.
Yeah.
You know, most probably when we were babies, they used the exact same thing.
When our parents were babies, yeah.
Yeah.
About,
you know,
50 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was reading the article. They wrote an article about you on the Nelson Mandela Children's Home website. And there were a lot of things that you put onto the cot to make it more functional.
Mm.
Let's get into that. Because I can imagine having to, more especially with kids, psychologically even, having to be stuck in one place all the time and you can't be moved because they can't put any attachments onto this thing.
Mm.
Let's get into the functionality of the cot itself.
Cool. You know, when I first met a pediatrician, and he was an old guy, and he's a fantastic mentor, and I spoke to him about, you know, what is the first requirement that you need for a cot? His answer was quite simply, he says, it needs to be a prison, but it needs to be a nice prison.
Yeah.
And it was really that you need to keep a child immobile. You need to keep them from moving around while you're doing the delicate medical procedures to get them better.
Yeah.
A couple of physiotherapists will hate me for it, but the nurses like them to be still, and the physiotherapists like them to be moving.
Yeah.
So you kind of got to get this two-way street. You know, how do you enable one to happen and the other to happen?
For sure.
So what I landed up doing was saying, you know, the current cots can only come down on the two sides, which means that you can get access to the side of the child. Now, what happens if you got to do a medical procedure on their airway?
Yeah.
Right? So what they'll end up doing is they'll end up taking this kid and they flip them perpendicular to the bed, feet hanging off the other side, and they're trying to do sort of a tracheotomy or an intubation. For me, that just felt barbaric.
Yeah.
And as you say, it didn't change for 50 years. There was nothing of the cot that kind of started to evolve.
Yeah.
So when I looked at it, I thought that was the first thing that we got to change. So we put on head and foot access.
Mm.
A couple of the other guys have done it where you can remove a head panel or a foot panel. Now, I know at my place, you know, if I take anything off and it ain't got a string on it, I lose it.
For sure, for sure.
So it was part of the bed. That was the first thing. And the other thing was that they said, okay, the kids want to... When they feed the kids, specifically if they got to sort of promote digestion, so it's the sort of the younger guys, they got to prop them up on a pillow to get them to sort of swallow properly. And I thought, no, come on. You know, we can't be propping kids up on pillows in this day and age.
Yeah.
So we then changed the medical functionality of the mattress. So you can have the head up, the feet up, the whole body up.
Yeah.
So your various positions there. And then the other thing was getting rid of that cage thing. We got to get rid of those bars. Bars, it's like a prison.
It is.
You know, and it's got to be one, but it's got to get rid of that.
Mm.
So I went to a clear panel, and the idea was that it became this kind of window to your world.
Mm.
One of our guys in school sent me he gave me a journal, and in the front page of it, I think we were in matric or something like
okay.
that. He said, he wrote the first page for me, and it was a story about, I think it was two guys in hospital. And the one guy sat by the window, and the other guy sat in the middle.
Yeah.
You know the story.
Yeah.
And then the guy on the end's telling him how beautiful it is outside, and then when he gets, you know, I think he passes away. Or
yeah.
And that guy moves to the end, and it's actually a brick wall.
Yeah.
You know? And I thought, like, you got to have a view to the world. And as a kid, you got to be able to interact with the world.
Yeah.
You know, if you're feeling better... Like, your parents are going to be able to check you.
Mm.
The nurses and the doctors are going to be able to have a proper view of you.
Yeah.
Specifically in wards, like, you want to be able to see right across the ward.
Mm.
And those bars started to mess that up quite a lot. So we put these nice clear panels on there. They're strong. They've got a little bit of elasticity. And the whole bed's made out of plastic. So, you know, putting all these things together means that we're answering the challenges of doctors and of nurses.
Yeah.
We're answering the challenges of parents looking after their kids. And at the same time, we're making sure the kid's got a lacquer environment to get better in.
Because, I mean, the kid has to be in there.
There's no choice.
You know, I can imagine for all of the people that you have just mentioned that are involved, I think the kid is the most important person in this whole thing.
Mm.
And the idea that you can... get them better without having to move them too much because the bed does what it does is actually ingenious, really. Let's get into some of, you know, the challenges en route to getting it done, getting the cot built. As a person in entertainment, my challenge is pretty basic. Like, okay, that invoice didn't come through. You know what I mean? Walk me through some of the challenges you had to overcome.
Yo. How long are we here for?
We got all day.
That the challenges of starting your own business is one thing. The challenges of starting your own business, making a product that doesn't exist, is another thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole way this thing started off was I took this little baby model, this little doll's model, you know, the size of about, you know, a school ruler.
Yeah.
And pitched up to the Nelson Mandela Children's Hospital and said to them, guys, this is what I got, you know. And they suddenly said, well, we've got to make this happen. You know, we've got to get this going.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, you know, they seem interested. I've got to make this happen. And at the time, I thought, well, it's very easy, you know. We take this thing, give it a couple of tweaks because that's all we need.
Yeah.
You know, I've got a BTEC. I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And we got to get a couple of bucks together, you know. Again, I got a BTEC, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And in a year's time, we'll have 50 of these. We'll have 100 of these ready, no problem. 4 years later,
yeah.
You know.
Yep.
Those challenges were like intense. Going from actually figuring out that we've got to take this concept, which was so infantile at the time, and not that it was in any way not right.
Mm.
It just needed so much to develop.
Yeah.
And the way even in which that I was trained to think about a part has changed. So that had to change.
Yeah.
And every single part had to get looked at to the point that we had to consider what the head of the screw was. You know, does it have a star on it or does it have no star and it's a hex head?
Yeah.
You know, like a standard big old bolt that you buy from the Mica.
Yeah.
It makes a big difference because if you've got a head that's got a cross in it, it's going to collect fluids. You're going to get bacteria stuck in it.
Yeah.
Now, that's something in the beginning that you think, well, I'll never think about that.
Yeah, yeah. And considering you don't have a medical background.
Well, you know, and this is the next challenge, is that you sit down saying, these are the things that I require from a design, manufacture kind of business perspective. But then you've got to sit down and go to all these nurses and doctors and say, well, you know, what are your thoughts here?
For sure.
So 150 nurses and doctors later, we finally came up with what we did.
Yeah.
You know, in the same time, it was also the business side. I mean, how do you get the capital to put this thing together? And that was a challenge. And at the same time, how do you run it? You know, what are the ops things? And small things that you don't really consider, which at the beginning of the year, I still wasn't considering.
Yeah.
You know, what cleaner do you need to clean the product with before you wrap it and ship it?
Mm.
Now, it's not a hard question. And it's not very difficult for a medical company to do that. I mean, we've got the right contacts, but you've got to still think about it.
Yeah.
You know, and now you've got to actually implement that. So it's another thing you've got to put on a very long list of things to start to do.
Mm.
But challenging, definitely, but rewarding more than ever.
I can imagine. You actually have a name for the cot itself.
Simba.
Simba. Let's unpack that story. Why Simba?
So the Simba Pediatric Hospital bed was me finding a name in college for this thing. You know, and at the time they want you to give this prototype and the nice cool images and the whole explanation about how you got there and a big old thesis to tell you why it's a good idea.
Yeah.
And a name. And I had everything else checked except for the name.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, okay. So we brainstormed. You know, the dictionary was completely messed because of the time we were done with it.
Yeah.
You know, we scribbled everywhere and we thought, well, we'll take a bit of that name and a bit of that name. And it was just like, no. I came up with a name, I presented it, and I've never got such backlash from my crit committee. And it was quite scary. They just looked at me and they said, yeah, not, eh?
Oh, yeah.
All right, fine, I left. So I went and sat in a bookstore and I thought, I'm going to find a name in this bookstore. Like, I'm going to stay here until this store closes. Otherwise, I'm going to, you know, somewhere.
Yeah.
So I landed up in the kids section and there was Nelson Mandela's favorite folk tales.
Okay.
And I started reading this and I thought, well, you know, Tata's got to give me some inspiration.
I've got
to find it somewhere.
You need that Madiba match.
So I landed up looking in there. It was a story of the lion, the hare, and the hyena.
Yeah.
And the lion's name was Simba. And I thought, well, if that ain't speaking to me, then I don't know what
the hell it is, man. Oh, man. And it's actually quite a nice name. It's not... I haven't heard anything other than the movie Lion King. You seldom come across the name Simba.
Yeah, it's quite weird. It's actually, there's something kind of nice about it. And there's something kind of, I think the whole thing about it is that, you know, I've made this cot and my big, big push is 98% locally manufactured, big local production, big local talent, big local innovation. What speaks of the African continent as a whole more than they say Simba?
Yeah.
It's a bit stereotypical, but it's something lacquer about it. There's something that speaks about, you know, where we come from and, you know, the kind of strength that we got.
For sure.
And it's the same that you want to imbue in the kid.
Mm.
You want to be that lion. You want to get better like that lion
for
and
sure.
Go out and roar and kind of be, you know, a whole lot better, not in a Simba, you know?
Yeah. Plus, I mean, the mental connection I made was to The Lion King, which was an animated movie, which was for kids anyway.
Exactly.
So, I mean, the connections just seem to pop up left, right, and center. You've actually done a lot more work for Nelson Mandela Children's Home. It was not just the cot.
Mm.
You also helped out with designing some of the other the seats, I believe, in the home. How did that come about?
Hey, that was another one, eh? I showed the interior designers at the hospital Simba, the bed.
Okay.
And I was very excited about it. And it was my only thing. It was my baby. It still is. And they, you know, we went away and I said we'd chat when we were closer to the end. And the next minute they came to me and they said, do you know an industrial designer? We're looking for some help. And I thought, well, you come to the right place, haven't you? Now, at the time, things were a bit slower in the design process. I wasn't as busy. So I said, sure, you know, like, what can I help you with? And they said, hey, we need these play walls. We've got this flat sketch. Can you do something with this? And I looked at it and I thought, well, yeah, I could try.
Yeah.
And the other one was, I said, they've got these little Play-Doh monsters. They're these little, you know, sort of the size of a Coke lid.
Yeah.
They said, no, they got these little things. They made this at a workshop at Funanani Orphanage out in Pretoria side.
Mm-hmm.
These kids were told a story, and they were sort of asked to replicate some of the creatures and thoughts and animals.
As they saw them in their minds.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they got Play-Doh. But these kids have never worked with Play-Doh. So they didn't have a clue what to do with the thing.
Yeah.
So the organizers had this little pack of googly eyes. And they gave all the kids googly eyes. And the next minute, monsters started appearing out of nowhere.
Out of nowhere, yeah.
These weird and wonderful things, from pigs to one-eyed weird creatures to these little alien-type monsters to these big sort of octopus-type things.
Mm.
Like really wacky.
Yeah.
And they gave me these and they said, we want these bigger. Don't know what they want to do with them, but we want these to be seats. So I literally took it and I blew it up and I scanned it and we made massive versions of the things.
Oh, wow.
And they're these amazing, colorful, cheerful monsters that dawn the family walk in the hospital. So there's three levels and there's three family walks.
Yeah.
And that's the entrances and accesses between the wards and the various clinical areas.
Yeah.
And these pass these gardens, these most beautiful gardens that you've ever seen in various themes.
Yeah.
So they wanted something to tie it back to the kids. And these crazy sort of squidgy monsters came out, and one's called Squidgy.
Yeah.
Squidgy, one-eyed dog, Piggy, and Croc. Croc is the coolest. He's got three big seats, and he's got these two big eyes, and he looks at you, you know?
It sounds like a lot of fun. It actually sounds like a hell of a time.
Yeah. I tell you, you know, doing stuff like that is more fun than anything else. It's a kind of hobby.
Right. It almost, you know, reassures you that you're doing the right thing.
I think so. You know, when I did these monsters, and, you know, the interior designer and myself worked together quite a bit, and she said, you know, Jed, I don't know how you're going to get this done, but, you know, you've signed up, you're going to do it, so, like, you know, in 3 months' time, bring me a monster. And the first day I put the first one out, she was down there and she offered to help me move this thing around. These things are massive. I mean, they're like, the croc's nearly 3 meters long.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, you've got to move this thing around with two people and it's got these steel seats on it. And we put it down and we stepped back and we both took a look at this thing. And she said, you know, Jed, never in my career have I looked at something and said, that would be really cool, but I'll never see that come to reality.
Yeah.
And this is the first time that I've seen something like this that was a crazy idea come together.
Yeah.
And that moment is the thing that I think industrial designers, that we, it's our addiction.
Yeah.
It's that little bit where you get to the end of a 3-year project or a 6-month project and you look and you stand back and you think, gee,
yeah,
I really got that one.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's never always good. You know,
yeah,
sometimes you
sure.
step back and you think, oh man, but that drives you, keeps you going.
Ah. I mean, it sounds fantastic. Mm. It sounds fantastic. You know, given that you've done so much, you know, with your time, I can only imagine what you have essentially given to those kids on more than a physical level. I can understand things being put there and, you know, the obvious advantages, like, you know, being able to move the child and, you know, and seating and whatnot. But on a psychological level, making everyone happy, you know, and connecting, like the energies connecting all together. I really cannot fathom how that must feel. How do you let go of projects? Because now I can imagine the cot is up, it's done, it's finished, the chairs are there, they're proper, anyone can sit on them now. What's next? How do you move on from... Because I would imagine this is a monumental thing you've done here.
Yeah.
How do you move... What's next? How do you move on?
You know, I don't know. it's like a question a couple of people have asked, and they said, you know, what's... You know, so, I mean, my company's Praystet. We do these medical devices. It's always been set up that it's not only Simba. That's the first of many, and
yeah.
it's part of the whole setup, you know. When I came up with the name Praystet, we sat down, it was weird, it was like Google telling me something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They said, I was looking for a name, and I was typing in a couple of things, and I think I came across something in Alfa Romeo.
Mm.
And one of their mottos meant something let, or something kind of Latin-y.
Okay.
So I typed in what I thought I should have, roughly, in the name. And literally translated it into from Latin to English. And I typed in, let it be beta.
Okay.
And popped Prestet.
Prestet. Yeah.
And that was it. You know, that was the name.
Yeah.
And that's always been the plan. Like, what's next is to let it be better for everything. You know,
sure.
For all these medical devices. But I think I can't help but moonlight. You know, I can't help but stick into these little weird projects. And I like the medical field because I think it's an interesting challenge. You've got a user, specifically in kids, sometimes in adults, but you've got a user who can't speak. You can't go to a kid and say, hey, kid, how's this cot?
Yeah.
Oh, it's great, thanks. You know,
yeah.
You know, like, they don't even grasp English yet.
Mm.
So now, how do you gain that kind of information out of them? So what you'll end up doing is you're going to the doctors and the parents and saying, well, what do you think?
Yeah.
What do you know of your child's experience? And they go, well, from experience, he's not crying, so he must be okay.
Yeah.
But I think for me, it's taking that even further, is to look at how do we better Simba itself, you know, because I don't think... As a designer, you can never let it go. You know, we can never say it's done.
Yeah.
That's just never going to happen.
Yep.
So I'll constantly be innovating it. I've made changes even in this production run. Not big ones, but, you know, I think there's a bit of thing I've got to satisfy to kind of, you know, do some changes.
Sure.
But I think I'd like to carry on with this. I think I'd like to carry on making cool and new products that are innovative and represent our country. Because I think our country's got so much to offer. And we've got so many challenges to answer. But those answers are so globally relevant.
Yeah.
So
locally manufactured, globally relevant.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, that's what's on the brochure, right?
Yeah.
And it's really about making these products that look at the psychological side of things. You know, that look at making an environment that makes you feel better, that makes you recover quicker, that makes you feel better about where you are.
For sure.
Being in hospital is not lekker.
It's never fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and especially for a kid who still can't answer you, how do you feel? You know, so you want to make this environment as nice for them as possible. But at the same time, you want to continually innovate it because technology keeps changing.
For sure.
And I think it's even with those monsters and you know, further challenges in making sort of these installations in hospitals and working with children's hospitals around the world. I've had a bit of an interesting conversation about doing some actually radio desks, you know what I mean? And it's like, it's a weird thing, but because it's kid orientated, you've got to change your thinking to it.
Yeah.
So if that's what's next, it's continually change my thinking every day.
That sounds great. That sounds great, man. Jed, how do we keep up with you on social media platforms, man? How do people get involved? Do you guys have a website? If there are some people that might have a interest in industrial design and want to find out a bit more, how do we keep up with you?
I'm sort of getting into the social media side of things, but I'll launch the website for Prestet kind of quite soon, probably before the end of the month is our launch date.
Okay.
So it's www.prestet.com. We've got a LinkedIn page, should have a Twitter page quite soon, but my Twitter page is at Jed Aylmer, so JedAylmer.
Man, you know what, I feel like we've been through so many things, and I can't begin to thank you enough for coming through, man. When the idea that we came up with for the show is to speak to people just like you, that look at the status quo and decide, you know what, this does not make sense to us, and we need to evolve and we need to innovate. And I think you're doing amazing things, man. Thank you so much for coming today.
Hey, it's been great to be here. And you know, I think you continually do cool things, and we continually make better things.
Yeah. All right. Just like that, man. We're out of here.
Thank you.
20 something. We'll be here next week, Friday, 2 p.m. Just like that. We're done.
This is CliffCentral.com.